Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with me. You know, we booked Azadeh Moavani weeks ago when her book Guest House for Young Widows Among the Women of ISIS first came out back in September. And then this weekend, while reading the book, it was so eerie to come across this paragraph about one of the young women she profiled. This says, summer 2014, Tunisia. The first time Olfa heard the name Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in 2014, it meant nothing to her, and she paid little attention. But over time, her daughters Rama and Gufran enmeshed in their new teenage lives as Salafi activists mentioned him more and more. They read passages from his sermons aloud to each other and called him by the honorific Emir. This past weekend, news broke of the military raid in Syria that resulted in the death of ISIS leader al-Baghdadi. ISIS once controlled a stretch of territory as large as Great Britain through unrelenting violence and patriarchal religious order. However, the death of al-Baghdadi doesn't mean the end of ISIS, and the understanding of the organization's rise is crucial, and that includes the role of women. Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist and academic Azadeh Moavani's latest book, Guest House for the Young Widows, is the first to reframe the history of ISIS through the stories of women who joined the organization. It tells the stories of 13 women who often left their homes to support a new state that offered, as she writes, a twisted way to achieve dignity and freedom through an embrace of politics that ended up violating both. The book reveals their complex and conflicting motivations, as well as the consequences they suffered and the brutality of the regime. Azadeh Moavani is my guest today. Welcome to All of It.
Thanks for having me.
So the book features the stories of these 13 different women, and they're all very, very different. Some get involved with ISIS via the internet. One woman gets involved because she's kind of a latchkey kid and she's looking for company. How did you find these people to profile, and what did you consider when you wanted to include? What did you consider that you wanted to include?
Well, when I started working on this, it was right when ISIS was kind of at its height, or at the beginning of its height, 2014. It was quite difficult speaking to women who had gone and traveled to Syria. So I started around the margins. I spoke to young women who had joined ISIS when it took over their hometown in Raqqa, and they had escaped, and they were living as defectors in southern Turkey. I spoke to young women who had tried to go from London, from Tunisia, and who had been blocked, and who could tell me about why they might have been motivated to try. I was looking to humanize and to understand better why young women would be so drawn to a group that seemed so cruel and so harsh to women, and to have a better context for why that decision would make sense to them. I think in the media we understood, and a lot of the coverage of ISIS made it a story about religion, but really country to country there was a much wider political and social context, and I wanted to be able to fill that out in a human way.
That's interesting you brought that up. That was my next question, because you do highlight women from different places. Lena was in Germany, another one in Tunisia, another in Syria. Why was it important to include geographic diversity to tell this story?
Well, partly because ISIS exploited the kind of cracks and the desires and frustrations of women in so many different societies in a really bespoke and cunning way. It reached out to young women in Tunisia who were kind of reeling from their post-Arab Spring uprising. Women were so at the center of that uprising in Tunisia, as they were in many parts of the Arab world. And I thought it was crucial to sort of locate ISIS in the aftermath of the failed Arab Spring and the hopes of women. So really, it was kind of, in country to country, it was the political story of that country and women kind of trying to find a way to be active.
You know, I wasn't able to connect with you because you're calling via Skype. Would you just pronounce your name for me so I make sure I say it correctly?
Sure, Azadeh Moavani.
Okay, I was really close. My guess is Azadeh Moavani, journalist and academic and the author of Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS. Probably the most famous and infamous story of recruitment is that of the Bethnal Green girls. A lot of people might remember the story, but for those who, it's just sort of ringing a bell, would you mind recounting this for us?
Sure. So these were three girls from a urban London high school, East London. The neighborhood is known as Bethnal Green. So in London, they're known as the Bethnal Green girls. And they became a global story when they went to join ISIS in early 2015. And the images of them walking through the airport became really iconic. They were wearing a leopard print scarf. One of them was wearing a yellow sweater. They looked like young cosmopolitan teenagers going on their first trip to Paris. But really, we sort of watched in horror as we learned that they were all going to Syria, and they had been groomed and recruited in their neighborhood in London. And these were popular girls. They were academic high performers. You know, they were not girls at the margins. And the way that ISIS kind of spun its web out across Instagram, Tumblr, they were on Twitter. You know, I read their social media posts, and they really thought that they were going to live in some kind of utopian Islamic homeland where they could be good Muslim girls, they could cover their hair, they wouldn't get kind of racist, a racist hard time for doing that. And so it was, for me, as a career Middle East correspondent, it was bizarre to see the violence of really what was an Iraqi-Syrian war story spin itself all the way out into Europe and kind of lure these young teenagers in. Why did it have anything to do with them is what I wanted to find out.
You mentioned a Tumblr and their Facebook pages and ISIS's active recruitment online, very active. How did they specifically target young women online?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, first, ISIS did something different than any jihadist or militant group, whatever you'd like to call it. It did something different than any such group before, and that's that it reached out to women directly and it offered them membership on their own terms. This is not the kind of staid, you know, Al-Qaeda's of yore, which only wanted women at the periphery as sort of wives to the fighters. It offered women a kind of pathway, and I think it was tapping into, as I was saying before, this kind of youthful, feminine activism of the Arab Spring. It saw that this was a generation of women who wanted to be active. So that was one thing. It kind of offered women a role in their own right, and I think it tapped into that. Secondly, I think it really directed itself to the frustrations of specifically young girls in Europe and in the West who had identity confusion. You know, growing up as Americans or Londoners or as French women, but coming from a Muslim culture where I think it was very hard for them to tread that line. And so it sent out messages, you know, kind of faking like makeup ads saying, you know, covered girl, come here and you can practice your faith. You're not going to, be ridiculed. You can be feminist here, but conservative at the same time. So it really, I think, kind of pinpointed the identity anxieties and also the growing political awakening of these young women. It talked about Guantanamo and Islamophobic hate crime and these things that young women were becoming attuned to, but of course, you know, exploiting all of that for its own purpose, which, as we came to see, was, you know, had nothing to do with these concerns, but was really about, you know, very cruel and violent territorial expansion in Iraq and Syria.
You know, often the media refers to these young women as jihadi brides. How accurate or inaccurate is this trope?
The jihadi brides nomenclature is really frustrating because it strips out young women's agency. Many of them, you know, and not talking here about the ones who were under 18, because I think they were not of a legal age to be accountable. But in many countries, there were women who were older than that and who made a choice. It made sense to them for political reasons, sometimes just pragmatic security reasons. ISIS had taken over their town and they had to stay safe, and sometimes collaborating with it was the only way to do that. So I think the idea of brides and focusing on their femininity strips out all of that context that we really need to look at to understand, you know, how this group emerged in the first place.
My guest is Azadeh Moveni. She's a journalist and an academic and author of Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS. Did you encounter, and I kind of got a sense of this with one of the women, that as they moved deeper into being a part or being adjacent to ISIS, that they did question at one point. One of the women at one point said that she felt like ISIS was the third person in her marriage.
Yes. I think for many of them, many of the women that I write about, it was what they found upon actually landing in Syria and living under ISIS territory. It was an immediate kind of awakening. They had to stay at these guest houses. The book takes its title from these guest houses where they had to wait when they were waiting to be married off to fighters. But ISIS was terribly totalitarian. It wanted to control everything. It was unjust. I mean, it was the most totalitarian system you can think of. And yes, I mean, some of the women said that their husbands had told them they had to take birth control pills because they wanted to go on suicide missions and they didn't want to leave children behind. And it was as though they were part of almost The Handmaid's Tale, really, you know, living in a universe where everything was controlled and really at you know, controlled by a force that had violence at its core.
How much of the draw of ISIS for the women you spoke to was about religion, and how much was about a sense of either rebellion or self-determination?
That's such a good question. I would raise another theme.
Sure.
And if there's one theme that might knit them all together, I think it's a sense of exclusion, especially in the countries of the Arab world where women joined in large number. I think we have to understand many of them were of backgrounds because of class or education or the neighborhoods where they lived in or their sect, their degree of piety, where they were really excluded from politics. They had no pathway to political empowerment of any kind, or they were navigating, you know, countries that had collapsed where there was just terrible insecurity, or were living under cities where, because, you know, they were Sunni, they were very, very much at risk of sexual violence. So, you know, excluded from safety, excluded from politics. So I think kind of at the core, that's a theme. And you know, these women from the West, I think, who felt excluded from citizenship of the mainstream. They didn't feel themselves to be British. They felt excluded from being French. And then I think if you overlay over that some sense of sisterhood. I think there was, for especially the young women, a sense that they were all off on some adventure together. You know, these are they're called kind of push factors, rebellion, wanting to kind of outdo their parents by being better Muslims. And certainly, you know, I think religion was a part of that. It inflected it. They thought that they were doing a pious and correct thing by going to join and become a part of the caliphate. I think that idea resonated tremendously for young people who wanted religion to be more a part of their lives and were experimenting with different ways to do it. And especially, you know, I think those who were lured online by YouTube sheikhs, by people who came from a very hardline, intolerant Islamic kind of background and persuaded them that this was, you know, the only way, that they were wrong not to do that.
What roles were women able to take on in ISIS?
Well, it really depended on what skills they had to bring. If they were coming from the Arab world, if they were coming from Morocco or Tunisia or Saudi Arabia or Turkey even, I mean, if they were doctors, they could be doctors. They could work as language teachers. Many of them trained women in religious studies. If they were skilled in kind of online multimedia skills, they worked in propaganda units. So really, whatever they were able to bring, they were able to work in that capacity. I mean, they didn't have leadership roles, I think we have to say. And many of them quit once they saw what a terrible and cruel kind of regime it was. If they had been doctors and kind of were teaching women languages from Europe, they quit and stopped doing that. But the idea, the promise had been, you know, come to us, bring what you know how to do and do it in the service of our state. And many women thought that, you know, that's what they would have been offered. Of course, we know the reality, you know, for so many ended up being, you know, crushing. None of that was possible.
So what would a woman's options be if they suddenly, or not suddenly, they realized over time, I don't want to be a part of this anymore?
Well, this is such an important question because for the most part, there was no out with ISIS. If you tried to escape, some were killed. Some had their children taken away as punishment, or they were simultaneously put in prison and they had their children taken away. The punishments were very severe. And that's why, you know, I think now when we're looking at these thousands of women who've come out of ISIS or who are former ISIS members, and we're dealing with the question of should their home countries take them back, you know, this reality that there was no out, there was no way to fix that mistake, and many of them really suffered terribly as well. And I think we have to take that into account when we judge them.
And before I let you go, as I was saying, when I was reading the book, the amount of times al-Baghdadi came up in the book, it was very eerie to be reading it. And as one point in the book, I think you describe him as a scorpion. So I wanted to get your take on what happened over the weekend. What were your thoughts when you heard?
I thought it would happen sooner than later. So part of me, you know, I don't think any of us who covered ISIS thought that it would be the kind of 10-year wait that, you know, the years-long hunt for bin Laden. I was torn as to whether, and I am torn, I think it's really important not to overestimate or underestimate his importance to the organization. I mean, he only appeared in public twice. You know, as the book shows, he had tremendous resonance, but I think ISIS managed to develop itself into such a capable organization with a kind of blueprint that it spun out across the world into its affiliates. So I think that kind of remains. And so even though the personality is gone, this very insidious model that he managed to export quite successfully, I think we will still contend with.
If you want to learn a lot, you should read the book Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS, Azadeh Movani. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.